Crossing the Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, you're probably familiar with Olympic sports like gymnastics, basketball, the 100-meter dash. What about painting or solo synchronized swimming? Coming up, we'll look back at some of the most unusual moments in Olympic history, including peculiar events, forgotten records, controversial moments, and more. Now, the CDC updated its mask recommendations this week, saying fully vaccinated people should go back to wearing masks in public indoor places where there's high transmission of the virus that causes COVID-19. It's a change from a couple months back when the agency said people who are fully vaccinated didn't have to wear masks, inside or out. The new guidance comes as the Delta variant continues to spread across Wisconsin and the U.S., and it's raising new questions about how to figure out when a mask is needed. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about the new guidance on masks from the CDC? Do you monitor what virus transmission is like where you live? How are you thinking through where you do and don't need a mask? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Devlin Cole is chief resident of preventive medicine at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Cole, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
I want to give a listen to start to the head of the CDC, Dr. Rochelle Walensky, talking about why this update was needed in a press briefing on Tuesday.
Information on the Delta variant from several states and other countries indicates that in rare occasions, some vaccinated people infected with the Delta variant after vaccination may be contagious and spread the virus to others. This new science is worrisome and unfortunately warrants an update to our recommendations.
Dr. Cole, can you share your thoughts on why it might have been time for an update on mask guidance?
Yes, absolutely. I really like Dr. Walensky's use of the word update, because we are still moving forward in this pandemic. We have a new variant, as you've mentioned, Delta, which has, it's mutated. When viruses replicate, they make little typos. And this particular typo has made it better, faster, stronger. And we are seeing those effects. As people are vaccinated, they are very well protected, but we are seeing cases of asymptomatic positives when we're testing in a surveillance mode, and we are seeing a little bit of symptomatic cases come through, about 1% of hospitalizations, 1% of deaths. So again, vaccines, very effective, very good at protecting, but as we're seeing the case count climbing, we are going to use all of the tools in our arsenal, and masks are an incredibly effective tool at stopping transmission of viruses.
What do you think of this in terms of health communication? Because it's a multi-stage sort of thing here. Yes, wear masks if you're in an area where there's high transmission. So, okay, I'll go and look. You could find maps online showing this county is low, this one's moderate, that one's high. I don't know. Do we need simpler messages, or does it make sense to have this kind of nuance to say, if you're in this part of the country, in this place, wear masks? If you're in this other place, maybe not.
That's a great observation that you're making. And I think a couple of factors are at play. You're right. This communication is not as clear and straightforward as it could be. But they are allowing for differences as the virus unfolds in different ways across the country, because we're not seeing the same mask adherence in different states or even counties, and we're not seeing the same vaccination rates in different states or even counties. And the virus doesn't really care if you are a Republican or a Democrat or who you are, if you are high up in the state or just a regular citizen. It's going to go where it can transmit the fastest. And so this CDC guidance is allowing a little bit more flexibility. However, it's really a guidance. What's going to have to happen is local governments, local businesses are going to have to interpret that for themselves. And they're the ones that are going to be in charge of making regulations that will make it a little bit clearer to kind of the average American citizen when and where I need to use a mask.
We're seeing, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, we're seeing some Wisconsin counties, for example. I know give mask recommendations, not mandates, but saying, hey, you know what? We're worried about this. Let's throw those masks back on. Why don't you, when you go out in public for you? And I'm sure people ask you all the time, Dr. Cole, do I need to wear a mask in place X at the grocery store, say, or whatever? Right. What do you suggest to people if they're thinking about, do I put those masks back in my purse or pocket or whatever?
Absolutely. I've been fielding this question a lot. And I first and foremost say, please have confidence in your vaccine. If you are a vaccinated individual, you have some insurance and protection currently. Our vaccines are still good. If you have not yet gotten your COVID-19 vaccine, you need to be wearing a mask pretty much everywhere where you're interacting with other people. And that guidance from the CDC has not changed. We all still need to be wearing the masks in transportation places, in healthcare settings. So really, we're thinking about places where I can't go out and visually identify who's vaccinated and who's not. And there's a pretty significant risk of people coming within 6 feet of me. I'm imagining places like the grocery store. And if all of the counties in Wisconsin were at a moderate level, this wouldn't be as concerning. But even over the past few days, we've seen more and more counties move upwards into that substantial or even high transmission categories. So the easiest way, if you would like a visual picture, is to just go on the internet and search for the CDC COVID map. It gives you a nice pretty picture. You can look for orange counties or red counties, and you know that you need to keep your mask with you. But if you have someone at home that's older or immunocompromised or a younger child that's not yet vaccinated, I might recommend that you consider keeping your mask on you as well.
We're talking to Dr. Devlin Cole, Chief Resident of Preventive Medicine at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at new mask guidelines from the CDC saying, hey, vaccinated people, if you're in a high transmission area for COVID-19, maybe get those masks, or actually not just maybe, put those masks back on as you go out into public places. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the latest guidelines on masks, on the progress of vaccines? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Cole, we heard from Dr. Walensky in that clip earlier talking about vaccinated people sometimes getting COVID-19, being able to transmit it. The name that people have used for that is breakthrough cases. We knew all along, no vaccine in the world, I think, has been 100% effective. We knew there'd be some of those cases. How worried are you now about, you know, people who have been vaccinated still sometimes getting COVID-19?
So there are different levels of worry. I think the ones that we're all the most familiar with are hospitalization and death. Those are very visible and very trackable. Dr. Walensky on Tuesday came out and said that every single COVID death at this point is preventable. We have an extremely effective vaccine that will prevent you from death. So on that sense, if you are vaccinated and getting a breakthrough COVID case, I am less concerned about those extreme outcomes. There's still a black box of long-term COVID, long-haul COVID symptoms that we don't really know what the impact is going to be. So I want as few people to get COVID as possible to avoid that kind of unknown ramification. And then there's also the reality that every single person that gets this virus is giving the virus a chance to mutate and make typos and potentially create a version of itself like the Delta variant, which is better, faster, stronger, and potentially going to make the vaccines that we do have not effective. And that is the real worry going forward from a public health standpoint. And masks are incredibly effective at stopping transmission. So that's why, even if you are protected against pretty severe symptoms of COVID because you've gotten your vaccine, I still want people to wear masks so that they are not transmitting it to other people and potentially it's not turning into something worse.
Getting back to the health communication side of things, we had, a limited supply of vaccine early on, of course, because they were just spinning up production. A lot of people eager to get it. Well, we're past that now. We've got lots of vaccine out there. The question is, can we get enough more people vaccinated to really slow down, especially this new variant? The president is making the case. Leading Republicans are making the case. What do you think needs to happen to keep giving people incentive and access everywhere to be able to get the vaccine?
Absolutely. Access is critical. We have to make sure that the vaccine is available where people are, that their questions are able to be answered, that we're taking all of these concerns seriously and working together as a team. But I'm not exactly sure what the magic answer is going to be. Historically, we often run into having mandates requiring that in order to participate in X, you need to do Y. And that additional pressure tends to motivate people to go and wear their mask or get their vaccine. So we're putting on kind of an additional requirement, masks, even for vaccinated people, but masks have not been pulled off for unvaccinated people. That's not quite the pressure that we need to get everyone vaccinated, although of 12 and over American citizens, we've hit about 56%. So we're still on our way. If you can think of a magic communication tool, Rob, I am all ears and would love to use it. I work primarily with adolescents, and they are oftentimes a sector of the population that don't buy insurance. And this kind of COVID vaccine is kind of like an insurance plan. So there's a feeling of invincibility that I really want to press upon people that you do not have the luxury of having with this virus.
We're talking to Dr. Devlin Cole, Chief Resident of Preventive Medicine at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. She's with us today to talk about the CDC's new recommendation that fully vaccinated people go back to wearing masks in public indoor places if they're in parts of the country where virus transmission is high. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you masking up even post-vaccination? Where do you do it? Do you do it in places where you have to, like on public transportation? Do you do it by choice when you go into stores? Have you seen masks around still? What questions do you have about the latest guidelines on masks and the latest efforts on COVID-19 vaccination? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about the latest update to the CDC's mask recommendations. The agency now says fully vaccinated people should wear masks in indoor public places where COVID-19 cases are spiking. And you can track that county by county online. Dr. Devlin Cole is with us from UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. And you can join in with your thoughts, your questions on these guidelines at 800-642-1234. And if you'd like to share your decision-making process on when and where to wear masks, even if you are vaccinated. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Let's go to your calls now. Joel is with us in Ironwood, Michigan. Joel, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. You know, I hear all of this information and requests about the virus and shots, but you know, they're missing something very important if you go back a number of years. I'm 78. I'll take you back to my teens and preteens when I had to get measles, mumps, chicken pox shots when I was a child. I didn't balk at it. My parents didn't balk at it. We just went and felt it was necessary.
Joel, thanks a lot for the call. What do you think of that comparison, Dr. Cole? Many people, not everyone, gets those childhood immunizations, the MMR and whatnot for their kids without thinking about it. Some pushback from time to time. What do you think of the comparison?
I want to thank Joel for getting his vaccine. That is the best thing that he can do for himself, for the people around him. And I've really seen pretty incredible vaccination rates in the 65 and older categories. Dane County is the highest vaccinated county of all of the counties in Wisconsin. And of the 65 and older, it's an incredible 93% of them have gotten their vaccines. So it's incredible because the virus definitely targets older people, although the Delta variant is targeting younger and younger adults. But I really do say hats off to the greatest generation for getting in there, doing their duty, and protecting themselves and the nation.
Thanks for that call, Joel. We'll go to Tucker now in Madison. Tucker, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking the call. I'm just worried that this new recommendation might undermine some of the promises that the CDC and the health officials have been saying about what the vaccine enables you to do. So one of the biggest draws of getting vaccinated is that you no longer have to wear a mask and can participate in these, you know, social things that we were precluded from. And so I'm just wondering that, or worried that, with this new recommendation, it'll disincentivize people who are already skeptical of getting vaccinated now that they don't have that motivation of not being, you know, not having to wear a mask. And so people who are already skeptical of it will have no further motivation to, and it'll stunt our progress with getting vaccinated.
Interesting, Tucker. Thanks for the call. Dr. Cole, what do you think?
Tucker, that's a great point. Public health officials have carrots and they have sticks. And you have identified a big carrot. And I think that we tried to use that pretty effectively over the past 2 months. But even during that time, the rates of vaccination continued to fall pretty significantly. So that carrot was unfortunately not as effective as we wanted it to be. And also, I can't in good conscience support continuing to offer benefits if they really are putting people at risk. So there's, you know, from my own personal view, as I'm giving people individuals guidance, is I want to keep them as healthy as possible. But I do have to take your point and say, yes, let's look at where we were a year ago. We were not hugging our loved ones. We were not visiting with our grandmothers and grandfathers. We were alone in our houses. And there has been a change. This is not walking all of that back. This is just putting a little bit of fabric on the bottom half of our face when we go out in public. If you and your loved ones are still vaccinated together and you are just you in a pod, that is still available to you. That is definitely an advantage of getting vaccinated.
Thanks a lot for that call. We are talking to Dr. Devlin Cole from UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the latest guidelines on mask wearing from the CDC. Back to your calls now. Nancy is with us in Wausau. Nancy, hi.
Hi. I have a 17-year-old that is going to be a senior in the fall, so I've been wanting to get him vaccinated. And in calling around, they have said that with anyone under the age of 18, they have to get the Pfizer. Really wanting to have him do the Moderna, and I'm just wondering what their reasoning is.
Nancy, thanks for the call. Yeah, my understanding is only the Pfizer vaccine, Dr. Cole, has been approved for that 12 to 17 age group. Please correct me if I'm wrong.
That is a good summary so far. The EUA is continually adjusting those things. So I would definitely go by the recommendations of your local pharmacy or doctor's office, whoever you're following. I don't want to step on their toes.
All right. Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Taylor is with us now in Racine. Taylor, hi.
Hi there. Nice to talk to you guys. My question is, I'm going to a wedding next weekend. I'm fully vaccinated. It's down in southern Alabama, which is also a really COVID hotspot right now. I'm on the fence about going, and if I do go, do I take my mask off at all, even such as during dinner time? That's my question.
Interesting, Taylor. And yes, lots of hotspots in Alabama. Dr. Cole, what do you think?
Yeah, this is a tough one. You have to take a mask off to eat and drink, don't you? But so the recommendations is if you're not able to protect yourself with a mask, 15 minutes at 6 feet of distance. So that's tough inside. If you can be outside, that's better to be eating. Places with higher levels of air circulation. But as much as you can, I would keep that mask on in Alabama.
All right. Good luck to you in making that decision. Tim joins us now in Delavan. Tim, hi.
Hi. I would just like to add my perspective on the pandemic. I read before the pandemic started, I listened to the book Pandemic about 1918 flu pandemic. Mm-hmm. And it's just the same. The similarities are just striking. The politics, people didn't want to wear masks. They wanted to gather. And they just continued to spread the virus for several years. And I just see the similarities today. And I just don't understand how politicians have overtaken like common sense science. How we can demonize science and rally around politicians that don't have a clue about science.
Tim, thanks a lot for the call. Tim worried, Dr. Cole, that we didn't learn from past pandemics like the big flu pandemic and starting in 1918. Looking to the future, though, are there lessons you're hoping, Dr. Cole, that we learn this time around that we could apply, hopefully in the very distant future, to the next big outbreak?
Gosh, I hope we do. If nothing else, I think remember back to the very beginning of the pandemic where we didn't have enough masks and swabs to go around. I hope that we begin to stockpile. I hope that we send money to agencies that are hiring preventive medicine doctors, that we're really investing in those types of infrastructure, that even when we're not in a pandemic, we still have to spend money on those things. And that can be hard.
Thanks for that call. Just in our last few moments, Dr. Cole, we're watching numbers jump up in some states around the country, creeping up even here in Wisconsin and some other places. What are you watching for to see if we can bring that back down?
I'm watching our vaccination rates. And honestly, I'm going to be watching to see how effective masking will be. I do hope that people are responding to this new guideline. And that unvaccinated people are also masking up because we're all in this together. Vaccinated or not, this is still circulating. And I want everybody as protected as possible. If you are vaccinated and your loved ones are vaccinated as well, be sure to hug them. If they're not vaccinated, be sure to support them and listen to them and encourage them in whatever ways that you can to get vaccinated. And hopefully this will be a short-lived blip.
Dr. Cole, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
That's Dr. Devlin Cole, Chief Resident of Preventive Medicine at UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. She is with us today to talk about navigating the CDC's new mask guidance and how you can decide when you need to wear a mask. Coming up, we'll have some fun talking about the Olympics, especially some off-the-beaten-path events from the past, funny stories, unusual records, and a bunch of other stuff that I didn't know about. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, the global effort to distribute COVID-19 vaccines remains lopsided, but progress is being made. Jen White looks at the latest on the international effort to give everybody their best shot. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, when you think of the Olympics, you might think about the major events, a lot of pageantry, the Olympic rings, flags from around the world. But that's not the whole story. In fact, there's a lot of quirky stuff that's happened over the course of the 29 summer and 23 winter Olympic Games. For instance, did you know painting was an event? And then there's the guy whose official marathon time went over 54 years. He didn't win the gold. Speaking of medals, when do those start showing up? And what's the deal with the five rings anyway? Our next guest captures these unique and often forgotten moments in Olympic history in a new book, and you could join us at 800-642-1234. Are you an Olympics fan? What's your favorite unconventional Olympic sport? Is there a game or activity that you think should be in the Olympics? Is there a particular athlete or story that you think people ought to know more about? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, memories, or questions. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jeremy Fuchs is a sports reporter and writer. He's the author of Total Olympics, Every Obscure, Hilarious, Dramatic, and Inspiring Tale Worth Knowing. Jeremy, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, this book, it's obviously a labor of love, and you cover the good, the bad, and the ugly about the Olympics. After all this, what do you think about the Olympics? Do you still have that love for the games?
Well, given the fact that I've watched Olympics pretty much 24/7 since they started last week, I guess the answer would be yes. I've always loved the Olympics. It's always been sort of appointment viewing for me every few years. This year is no different. And so to get the opportunity to really explore them, sort of every inch of them was really a great joy for me.
As you're watching this year's Olympics in Japan, what has stood out to you for the update of the book in a couple of years? What stories are you seeing that you say, yeah, that would be in my book if I wrote it after this Olympics?
Well, yeah, I mean, given the COVID situation, you know, I feel like every day could be a whole other section of the book. I mean, just recently, there was an American track and field athlete who tested positive for COVID, and briefly, the entire Australian track contingent had a quarantine. You know, there's, because of the delay, which is unprecedented, and then, you know, the restrictions and sort of measures that are, you know, taking place on a daily basis. Yeah, it could be a whole separate book, probably.
Now, I teased a couple of the stories. You tell a lot of stories in your book. One of them, the missing marathoner who had a time that I could even aspire to complete a marathon. Could you tell the story of that? What was that, 54-year marathon?
Yeah, so Shizo Kanakuri, a Japanese marathoner. This is at the 1912 Games in Stockholm, Sweden. And, you know, before the Games, he was one of, you know, Japan's best, one of the better marathon runners in the world. But he gets to Stockholm. He had to take it wasn't so easy to get, to fly, you know, to go over the world at that point. And so it took him a while to get there. When he gets to Sweden, it's super hot for the marathon day. Actually, half the runners ended up bowing out because of the heat. Kanakuri is kind of going through it, and it's clear that the weather is affecting him. You know, being in a different time zone, all that is affecting him. And so, about midway through the race, he sort of veers off the course and kind of finds himself in the garden of a Swedish family. And the Swedish family was having a party or a picnic of some sort. And he sort of hung out there for a while. He fell asleep under a tree. He had some orange juice. And then afterwards he left, he was done. He went home. He just wanted to basically get the heck out of Dodge. And that was all well and good. He participated in the 1920 games. He would have participated in 1916 had those not been canceled due to World War I. And he went on with his life. But the Swedish Olympic officials thought he was missing, like an official missing person. They had no idea where he was. And it took them 50 years before anyone realized. It was a Swedish television program who found him 50 years later in 1957. And they, you know, said, hey, why don't you come on back? So in 1967, he came on back, he finished it. And so he holds the record, I guess, for the longest time it takes to finish a marathon. And that's 54 years, 8 months, 6 days, 5 hours, 32 minutes, and 20.3 seconds.
I'm glad they got it to the second, too. I wouldn't have accepted anything less. Now, I mentioned a lot of events have come and gone in the Olympics. So we've got skateboarding, for example, this year. A couple of weird ones, weird to me anyway, painting was an Olympic event. And there were other art events, too. Tell us about the art part of the Olympics way back in the day.
Yeah, so art in the Olympics from the 1896, the first modern games, to 1948, there was art in every Olympics. There was painting, there was sculpture, architecture, literature, you name it, it was there. And so the idea was Pierre de Coubertin, who was the founder of the International Olympic Committee, was very big on the sort of mind-body connection, you know, if the mind's working right, the body's working right, and vice versa. And so he wanted, in addition to sporting events, sort of these more intellectual, cultural events. And so for a long time, there was art. And as, you know, as you're hearing this, it's in a very incongruent fit, right? But they were judged, like many Olympic events were judged. There was, you know, plenty of medalists. Although what was weird about it is that, you know, in some events you might get, this is my favorite one, the dramatic work section in 1928 in Amsterdam. Somebody won silver, somebody from Italy won silver, but no one won gold and no one won bronze. It was just him. And there was other times where somebody won gold, but no one won silver and no one won bronze. It was a very sort of odd way of doing it, obviously. It was not canceled because it was art. It was canceled because, particularly in the early days of the Olympics, the idea of amateurism was, you know, front and center, the idea that you had to be an amateur to even compete in the Olympics. And for many of these artists were not amateurs, they were professional artists. And so that was actually the reason it was ended, not because it didn't make any sense.
Talking to Jeremy Fuchs about his new book, Total Olympics, Every Obscure, Hilarious, Dramatic, and Inspiring Tale Worth Knowing. And reading through your book, Jeremy, I think a lot of people have had the idea, and I've thought this at various points in my life, oh, you know, too bad the Olympics have gotten away from the pure thing before politics got involved or money or scandals or cheating or doping or whatever. That's one of those golden ages that may never have existed, if I'm reading your book right, right?
Oh, yeah. The Olympics have been political since the get-go. And I think you can trace the story of the world in many ways through the Olympics. It was, from the beginning, a way for countries to sort of assert themselves, to sort of make these grand gestures of, you know, we are the best. There was very little kumbaya. It was always a competition, and that's what it was meant to be. There was, in the early days, more of the amateurism where, you know, these athletes weren't professionals and they were just competing for sport. And that has, you know, obviously changed, but it has always been a sort of political venue that happens to have sports. And we've seen throughout history and, you know, up until today, you know, sort of these proxy wars being fought, you know, between countries during an event, you know, the Miracle on Ice and hockey, but even just individual events, you know, country versus country. And it's not just the U.S., it's all over. And so for us to sort of think that the Olympics are just all fun and games, yeah, there's certainly, you know, a large part of it is fun. And, you know, these athletes are doing it for themselves. But, you know, so we track the medals for a reason, right? It's a race between countries. And so this is a political thing. It's always been political. It always will be. And if anything, it's just gotten more as time has gone on.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Ben is with us in Watertown. Ben, hi.
Yeah, hello. You know, I remember the women's marathon when it first got going. There was a horrible moment where a female runner entered the stadium through a tunnel. And she was going to get all the glory, of course. She was going to be the winner. She's way ahead. And then some fake runner came out of the other end of the tunnel and stole all of her glory, I guess, all of her cheers. And the look on her face when she realized, you know, thought, did I somehow not realize there was somebody ahead of me?
Ben, thanks a lot for the call. I think that was not Olympics. Our producer, Rachel, found a story. That was the Boston Marathon back in 1980, it looks like. But that said, Jeremy, you found moments of cheating and chicanery at various points of the Olympics. Any stories you'd want to share?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we all know sort of the doping of the last, you know, 20, 30 years, and obviously that exists. To me, what's, you know, just as fascinating and in some ways more hilarious is what would happen in the early games. And it happened in the marathon. You know, athletes used champagne as sort of the energy drink of choice in the early 1900s. They used rat poison, was considered a stimulant, which obviously wasn't, actually had a pretty bad effect on the athletes. Rat poison, some brandy, some brandy and egg whites, actually. So, yeah. For as long as there have been sports, athletes have tried to get an edge. Over time, it's become more sophisticated and probably more effective. But if athletes are willing to put rat poison in their body, they're probably willing to do a whole number of things.
Ben, thanks for the call. We're talking about some of the quirky, weird, sometimes fun, sometimes inspiring things associated with the Olympics. Sports reporter and writer Jeremy Fuchs stays with us. His new book is called Total Olympics, Every Obscure, Hilarious, Dramatic, and Inspiring Tale Worth Knowing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite off-the-beaten-path Olympic event that you really get hooked on watching? Do you have a favorite event that's been discontinued? Maybe you've got an interesting story to share about a moment in Olympics history, or maybe you've got a question. What have you always wanted to know about the Olympic Games? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're talking about some of the unique historical moments in the history of the Olympic Games. Sports writer Jeremy Fuchs has a new book out. It's called Total Olympics, Every Obscure, Hilarious, Dramatic, and Inspiring Tale Worth Knowing. Forget basketball, gymnastics, and diving. How about pistol dueling, painting, or solo synchronized swimming? We're talking to Jeremy about legendary Olympic characters, too. Forgotten records, moments of controversy. You could join in if you have a moment that you remember you want to bring to our attention in the Olympics. And do you love watching them, maybe despite some of the stuff that goes on behind the scenes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jeremy, pistol dueling. Safer than I thought when I first saw that was an event. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so this was, you know, before Alexander Hamilton was, you know, back in vogue and duels were a thing. You know, shooting has a long history at the Olympics and it continues to this day. But for one sort of ill-fated, they did sort of dueling, obviously not with real bullets, but everything else was about as you would expect from a duel. They quickly realized, as they had done with Olympic events, that probably wasn't the best idea and kept it to only one. But there's a long history of that, of Olympic sports sort of appearing for one or two Olympics, and then they sort of realize that this is a really bad idea.
Is there one that you'd like to see make a comeback, Jeremy, from all your research?
Yeah, and this has gotten some like momentum over the years. There's been different movements, you know, very unsuccessful, but to get it back, and I think it's tug of war. In the early 1900s, tug of war was in three Olympics, and yeah, the Americans were actually quite good at it, and it was just like you imagine from the playground days. And I think it would be a very, first of all, it'd be fun just to see, you know, the sort of show of strength. And I think you could probably, you know, imagine getting some pretty amazing athletes, maybe some big names on the team, and you're just sort of going for it. I think that could be really cool. And the fact that it has its roots, you know, it wasn't just one Olympics, it actually was a few. I think it would make some sense, and I think it would get a lot of viewership. I think people would be, you know, pretty curious to give it a look.
And we focused on some of the weirder moments, but Jeremy, inspiring tales also made the cut for your book. Can you share maybe an inspiring or impressive Olympic performance or performer that maybe doesn't get, you know, their story told as much as they should these days?
Yeah, you know, one of the great pleasures about writing this book was getting to know some of these stories, right? And especially the ones, you know, from other countries or from, you know, from an earlier time. And to me, one of the most impressive and inspiring is the story of Eddie Egan. He is the only person to win the gold medal at both the summer and winter games. He was a boxer and he was a bobsledder. You know, there's a few athletes who have competed in both summer and winter. You've seen recently a trend of track athletes trying bobsled to some extent, but he was a fantastic boxer. He won in 1920, and then 12 years later, he won in bobsled. He was not an experienced bobsledder. He kind of just joined right before, you know, the game started. He was obviously an incredible athlete. He was a lawyer. He studied law at Harvard. He went to Oxford. He fought in World War II. He lived sort of an amazing, he also set a world record for fastest circumnavigation of the globe on different airlines. He was somebody who did just about everything, you know, to a very, very high standard. And that's sort of what you see through a lot of Olympic games. It's just people who are incredibly impressive, who achieve so many things, obviously on, you know, the competition field, but also off it. And to me, he's somebody that we kind of forget because it was in the, you know, 1920s and 30s, but it's somebody I think is worth remembering.
Talking to sports writer Jeremy Fuchs about his new book, Total Olympics, Every Obscure, Hilarious, Dramatic, and Inspiring Tale Worth Knowing. You can join in at 800-642-1234 if Olympics are a must-watch event for you, if you have a favorite moment from the past or a concern about the Olympics and how they work. 800-642-1234 is the number, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Jeremy, you've mentioned a couple times the initial idea of the amateur status of the Olympics, and you share the story of Jim Thorpe, who essentially lost medals for pretty much making lunch money playing minor league baseball. And now today, you know, you've got highly paid NBA superstars playing in the games. Can you talk about that bit of Olympic injustice?
Yeah, for the first half of the Olympics, up until the 60s and 70s, and really kind of ended in the 90s, amateurism was the stated ideal of the Olympics. The idea that these were, you know, quote unquote, ordinary people, not professionals, who could come together for this Olympic event. It was obviously never really the case. You know, Soviet athletes were sort of professional in their way, and they kind of looked the other way, but it is a bit odd to think of somebody like Jim Thorpe, maybe one of the greatest athletes ever, you know, in any sport of any country, you know, dominates in 1912 in track and field and gets his medals revoked because he basically made $2 a week playing minor league semi-pro baseball. And then you turn on basketball and Kevin Durant makes untold millions. It's obviously changed. Athletes can now sort of cash in on their Olympic medals with commercials and endorsements and other things like that. I think that's as it should be. You know, these are obviously world-class athletes. They should, you know, probably be compensated as such. And there are many who aren't. You know, if you don't win, if you're in a sport that is not very high profile, you know, you're often having to take on, you know, take on a full-time job in addition to training for the Olympics, which, you know, seems sort of impossible to do. And so, yeah, I think it's a change that still needs to happen. Obviously, there are many athletes who cash in quite, you know, quite handsomely. But there are many athletes now and throughout history who haven't been able to sort of get their piece of the pie.
And Jim Thorpe, something I learned from your book, not only was he an amazing athlete, he actually won medals in sports that he just had picked up a few months before the games. Like, he didn't know initially that the javelin throw, you could take a running start.
Yeah, you know, Jim Thorpe is, and I think in part because his medals were sort of revoked, they were later given back, but by then it sort of lost the power. We, I think now, don't realize just how amazing of an athlete Jim Thorpe was, in football, in track and fields, in baseball. He, you know, I think it's a fair thing to say he's probably one of the greatest athletes of all time, and being able to pick up basically an Olympic sport before the Olympics and then dominate is just unheard of, and you could not imagine anybody doing that today. So it's a shame that he got a raw deal and got caught up in this amateurism debate before, you know, people on a wide scale really knew and know just you know, how incredible he was.
Let's go back to our callers. Deborah is with us in Winona, Minnesota. Deborah, hi.
Hi, I am wondering if your guest has any stories about the equestrian events.
Ah, people and horses in the Olympics together. Anything you want to share, Jeremy?
Yeah, so equestrian obviously has a long history in the Olympics, and there's two stories that I think really stand out. One is one of my favorites, and it's a little apropos given the conditions we're in, but in 1956, the Games were in Melbourne, Australia. Every event except equestrian, there was a horse quarantine. So upon entering Australia, horses had to quarantine for 6 months, which obviously wasn't tenable for the Olympics. And so they decided to move the equestrian portion only to Sweden. And so they had an equestrian games, they called it. Queen Elizabeth from England happened to be in Sweden for sort of a royal trip. She hung out there. Her horse actually won a medal in that games. And they sort of had their own little Olympic party in Sweden, and while the rest of the games were happening, you know, on the other side of the world. And I think this has a little bit of, you know, some similarities mm-hmm. given our constant quarantining over the last year and a half. And then another story in the book is the story of a Mexican equestrian, Humberto Marley, is one of the best of all time, won multiple medals, and sort of after his career became quite the criminal, and was eventually became a sort of big drug deal and was caught, you know, and sentenced to a major prison sentence before dying shortly thereafter, which I always found a fascinating, you know, sort of riches to rags, I guess, type story.
Deborah, thanks a lot for the call with the question. And Jeremy, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
That's Jeremy Fuchs, sports reporter and writer. We talked to him about his new book. It's called Total Olympics, every obscure, hilarious, dramatic, and inspiring tale worth knowing. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 8, a House committee started its investigation this week of the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. Find out what's in the works in the months to come. That's tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's the news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then President Biden says U.S. combat operations in Iraq will end this year. We'll look at America's transitioning role in that country and get an update on our withdrawal from Afghanistan as well. Remember, you can follow all of these conversations here on the Ideas Network, on your radio, of course, but also online. Stream live at WPR.org or check out our extensive archives of past conversations. And you can download the Wisconsin Public Radio app to follow the Ideas Network and all the other stuff we do here at Wisconsin Public Radio. Download the Wisconsin Public Radio app onto your phone. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.